It's where you want.
Thank you. It is my pleasure today to introduce Alfred Snyder. Dr. Snyder holds the Edmund Lawrence Chair of Forensics at the University of Vermont. This is the opening lecture for the faculty for the World Fate Institute.
Good morning. One of the things that the World Institute, Debate Institute has really tried to do is to bring debate to new people and new populations. It's something that I've been doing for the last 15 years or so, and I really have to say that the beginning of my debate career, I was very much like many people in the college debate community. I couldn't imagine that it was possible to teach new people how to debate in college. I assumed that I needed to recruit people who already knew how to debate, and that's what everybody else does. That's what I did. My work at Boston College taught me that I needed to do this. My work at the University of Kansas showed me that I needed to do this. Right after finishing my doctoral degree, or at least my coursework, I went to work at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan with George Singer-Mueller. And George really taught me a very important lesson, that it is not only possible, but incredibly rewarding to train new people how to debate, and that there wasn't necessarily a limit that they couldn't go beyond. In fact, that the sky was the limit. And I participated in a program where we recruited people who had never debated from off campus. We taught them how to debate. We sent them to debate tournaments. And then eventually, they were doing extremely well, receiving the number two first round bid to the NDT, and many, many successes. And George showed me that it was possible to train new students how to debate. And when I came to the University of Vermont, I had a sort of a new perspective on that. But I thought I would continue with my old ways, since I didn't have all the support and the organizational tradition that George Singer-Mueller had. And I had a couple of obstacles. Those obstacles were the informers. The first one was that I was now teaching at the most expensive public university in America. So it was hard to get students to come from out of state, from Texas, to go to the University of Vermont when they could go to the University of Texas, which is an excellent school, for about one quarter of the cost. I was able to convince a number of students that this was true, would be a good idea, but I was having a hard time convincing their parents that this was a good idea. The second barrier I faced is that we had absolutely no scholarship money to give away, and so I wasn't able to use that to try to attract them. I didn't give up because I'm a person of habit and tradition. I kept trying, and at one point I succeeded in recruiting the high school debater who had been the top speaker at the Glen Brooks, top speaker at Wake Forest, and top speaker at Dartmouth. So I thought, I was all set. This is great. At the beginning of his sophomore year, he had a meeting with me and said, you know, I've been debating for what seems like most of my life, and I'd like to explore other things like romance and a second major. And I would like to study my religious heritage more closely at weekend study groups. And I think I've gotten a lot out of debate, so I'm not sure I want to debate anymore. And frankly, I have to say that for him, it sounded like a really good idea, and it was the right move. I had another recruiting meeting, and my students all gathered together to help recruit high school debaters. And I noticed that all the students who attended the meeting had never debated in high school. And I said, why are we wasting our time trying to recruit people who aren't even here? There are lots of people here. I should try to recruit them and train them to debate. What I decided, and it's become my slogan since then, is that all the debaters you need are already wherever you are. Wherever there are people, there are debaters. And I'm very proud of the debaters for the University of Vermont program who have excelled nationally and regionally, who never debated in high school. So, although I do not have an extensive experience of working with brand new students in high school, which will be the challenge that you'll be facing, I do have a lot of experience at training brand new people how to debate, people who have never debated before. I've also been closely observing the kind of training that students from playing ball in urban debate league programs around the nation have received, and tried to come up with some ideas based on my experience, what I saw, what seemed to be working, about how we could try to make teaching new debaters easier and more productive. There are many barriers that we as experienced debate people confront in deciding that we're going to teach brand new people how to debate. And I hope that in today's talk, I can talk about, so I can speak about some of the things that you should keep in mind, and the kind of atmosphere that you need to create in your work groups, and some guidelines for the communication behaviors that you engage in with your students. Let me just say, however, that as Larry Moss was pointing out yesterday in discussing our training for the new coaches who are coming, everybody has their own set of tools and procedures that works for them. Every one of us is a different coach. Much of your coaching comes from your personality and the essence of your being. Don't try to be some other coach. Try to be yourself and let that show through, because your genuine interaction with the students will in many ways get you a lot farther than putting on a false face of being someone you're not. Having said that, of course it's necessary for us to shape our messages so that they can be properly perceived and have the right effect on students. I think that as a coach, in working with students, there should be no message, none, that you do not form strategically to gain the results that you want from your students. And I think you can be genuine at the same time that you're trying to create those strategically formed messages. I want to start in a very abstract way by saying that in my experience, the most important thing that dictates whether students are interested, maintain an interest in debate, and advance is the kind of psychosocial environment that you create. In the space where you all interact, in the classroom, while doing drills, working with them in the library, practice debates, the psychosocial environment and how it's perceived by those students and everyone participating is essential. You, as the coach, have to be responsible for creating that psychosocial environment. You have to be self-aware. You have to constantly be thinking about what you're doing. You need to, as I've said, form each message strategically to accomplish what you want. And you need to realize that each incident in which you interact with students is an important communicative event. Quite often, students will latch on to some particular conversation or some particular interaction with you, which will be very important to them, but you didn't know that this was so important to them. Sometimes we need to listen to ourselves and realize what we're actually saying, and reevaluate our old communicative habits, out them, and replace them as necessary. Well, it's easy for me to tell you that you have to create the right psychosocial environment. But what does that mean? And I guess because I've been watching Pat Gino lecture too much about research, we'll start by thinking about keywords. And keywords are these concepts that you should keep in mind. And the psychosocial environment you want to reflect, you want to create, reflects these keywords. And I'll speak about it from a personal perspective. When I'm dealing with new debaters, I want them to know that each individual debater and each individual student is important, that I value them, that I have confidence in them, and that I see in them the potential for growth and achievement. It's amazing how people respond when you seem optimistic about them and their abilities early on in your relationship. They're not going to generally, I mean, they may question it inside, but generally they won't disagree with you. They won't be saying, oh no, I'm no good, I'll never be any good. You know, you'll get a little, oh really, I can be articulate, that I can be an incubator? I think the psychosocial environment we create needs to be a safe place, a place where students can volunteer ideas they may not be absolutely certain of, a place where it's okay to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes, because ultimately, that's the essence of education. You do something, you assess the consequences of doing that, you learn, you remodel, you try again, and get some more feedback. It's important to think of your group as a community. And for me, I think of a community as a group of people who are working together for some goal. The spirit of community is very hard to create. There's only one way I know to create the spirit of community. That is, you have to struggle together. When you struggle together for the betterment of everyone involved and work together, before you know it, you have a feeling of community. People have an investment in the other people there. People have an investment in the well-being and the success of the entire community. It's important, though, when we focus on that community, that it's a community in which each person is important and each person is valued. Sometimes you need to intervene to protect that psychosocial environment. You need to be in a situation to defend those people who are being made to feel unsafe or address communicative patterns that threaten some people. You need to have an environment in which it's okay for people to criticize, that criticism is viewed as an analysis of ideas, not an analysis of persons. Early on, I try to communicate with students that I'm very tough on ideas, but I want to be soft on you. And I think the best way I can help you is to be soft on you while at the same time being hard on your ideas. I think it's important to try to draw a distinction between you and your ideas about debate. That you, in terms of what I mean by that, I mean the students, positive, unconditional regard for that person, even though at some point they say things which are incorrect in your view and need to be criticized. This kind of psychosocial environment needs to balance positive and critical messages. And you need to make sure that you are always giving a balance of those messages. We'll be talking more specifically about how to create that, but those are a few key words that I wanted to express for the psychosocial environment you're trying to create to teach new debates. Once it exists, you're in good shape because it will recreate itself. The reason it will recreate itself is because that's the kind of environment people want to live in. People do not want to live and work in a psychosocial environment where they feel threatened, under the gun, unsupported, underappreciated. They want to live and operate in this positive psychosocial environment. Once you can get the ball rolling, it will tend to recreate itself. The early moments of your interaction with these students are critical. Their first impressions of you and what's going to go on in your teaching group are essential for determining their approach for the rest of the program. Be incredibly boring and dull in your first meeting, and it may take you days and days of joke telling to get them to tune back in. I strongly believe that everybody can debate, so we need to bring them on. I think oral communication is a daily and nearly universal experience. All of the students we work with already speak. They speak often. They speak in many detailed ways. They already have oral communication ability. They may need to be refined a bit for public presentation, but they're already quite able to speak. All the students you meet will have extensive cognitive abilities. The problem is that they may come from a school environment where they're often asked to be passive, when naturally they're very active, curious, inquisitive. So your brain is a lot like any other, well, it's not a muscle, but I'll analogize that it's like a muscle, and that it needs to be exercised and worked out in order to be powerful. Our students all come with those brains. You cannot teach students how to think. You may teach them what to think about and give them new ideas, and you may teach them how to organize their thoughts, but it's not necessary for you to teach these students how to think. They already know. It might be passive due to the effect of schools, the mass media, and the messages they're bombarded with that tell them that they're unimportant, irrelevant, and can't have an influence on the world, but it's there. It only needs to be activated. I, for example, experienced that. I was a terrible student. I've always been a terrible student. I can't deal with authority. I was a discipline problem because school bored me. I couldn't do well on grades because I didn't want to study. The teachers had to take books away from me in grade school because I wanted to read about Egyptian archaeology, not about the stuff that they were dealing with. When I found debate, all of a sudden I found that I was in front of the classroom giving a speech and everyone else was listening. And I said, all right, now we've got it right. This is the place for me. And that single moment in my first debate in the eighth grade changed everything in terms of my intellectual function. And I began to realize that ideas are important, that intellect is important, and it came to pass that I believed that my success would be linked to my brain, not to my connections, hopefully not to the sweat of my brow, because I would like to avoid manual labor. But it really made that difference. That point will come for the students you work with. That critical point when they become excited by ideas, philosophy, and the issues of public policy. There will be a moment when some of these students will gain their voice. It will quaver a bit. There will be a few likes and ums and ahs, but they will gain their voice. You will be there for that. Do not feel downtrodden by the duties you have as a debate coach. You will be there for a magical moment in the lives of so many of these young people when they learn that ideas can bring joy and when they gain their voice and express them. In dealing with these students, it's important for us to remember that achievement is relative. And all advancement is good. In policy debate, we're so bogged down in this great threshold analysis. That's not how most important things happen. Most important things happen linearly. And the progress of your students will be the same. As long as they're on an upward track, then you're doing well. They're making progress. As I often say, it's not how high they go. It's how far they come that really makes the difference. They may never win the state title, or the national debate tournament, or the National Parliamentary Debate Association Nationals, or CETA Nationals, or they may be eliminated after six rounds of NFL Nationals. But if debate has really helped them progress substantially, it's a success. I look into this audience, and I see people who've had this experience through debate, and you know that I'm talking to you right now. This is your chance to bring more people into the experience that has done so much for you. Debate, I believe, changes lives. As Melissa says, we blow minds for a living. I think also that debate teaches us what students really need, what we really need. Our society is one of passive, alienated individuals, largely trapped in an intellectual wasteland. Now, that's a broad, sweeping statement. It has some rhetorical punch to it. But let's think about it. What's going on in our society? We have largely dysfunctional work relationships. Just listen to people talk after they come home from work. Their work environments are based on status, ego, competition, blame, favoritism, hierarchy. Americans at large have poor advocacy skills. They can talk, they can engage in pre-linguistic grunting in reaction to some SportsCenter highlight, but they're not necessarily able to speak and advocate. Studies show that not only are the majority of teenagers unable to give basic oral directions to a common destination in their town, but also that the number one, the most commonly shared fear among Americans is the fear of having to give a speech. So we're not exaggerating when we say these students will gain their voice. Oh, they have a voice. Sure, they talked, but they didn't have a voice to advocate, to persuade, to influence. Our society is characterized by low levels of cognitive functioning. The danger is not that we will lose free speech in the 20th century. The danger is that we will have nothing to say. People are taught to be passive, to accept the intellectual agenda given to them by schools, by the media, by corporations. They're taught to trust the judgment of experts and believe in them and vote for whoever, whichever experts seem to be the most impressive. They often surrender to the conventional wisdom. This is exactly the opposite of what we need, and it's what debate training fights against. Now, if you agree that these are conditions we would like to lessen, in a linear fashion, of course, then now is an opportunity for you to try to do that on an important case-by-case basis. You can do that by trying to create a working relationship with your students, which is non-hierarchical, which stresses cooperation, which avoids blaming, and instead tries to use praise. And if there's a problem and somebody's worried about who's at fault, let's change the subject to how are we going to solve that problem. If somebody is at fault and needs to be educated, you can do that one-on-one, not in front of the whole group. You can take the blame. In speaking with a concerned parent yesterday, it was very disarming for me to say, oh, okay, fine, I believe it's all my fault. I apologize. Then, of course, the discussion has to move to the solution phase, because the blame is already taken. You can take the blame. You're big. You can handle it. It's important, I think, also not to play favorites, not to pick special kids. Those students who are not getting attention, you reach out to them and give them the attention that they want but may not be able to ask for. You need to show them the advocacy skills that you're trying to teach. You need to be passionate about ideas and arguments. You need to show them that you're excited about ideas. It's so fashionable to be cool. I don't care about anything. That's such a false positive role model for people. It's a negative role model. To be cool, nothing fazes me. That means nothing is important. That means there are no critical issues. Show them that ideas can produce passion. Be nice, dynamic. Be at ease. Be rhetorical. Show and appreciate the beauty of language use. Let your articulateness show to them when you talk to them. Don't break everything down into money, arrow up, good. Try to find ways to describe the things that in ways that are descriptive and that are articulate. Avoid slang and vulgarisms. Avoid slang and vulgarisms. Most of these students probably swear better than any of us. And besides, they're hip. They know the real youth jargon. We don't even know. And I think that you need to not model them. You don't necessarily impress them by swearing. And if you do it naturally, you need to stop doing whatever you want in your normal life. But I think when you're working with them, you need to show them the beauty of language. That doesn't mean that you can't use a specific swear word at certain pivotal moments for a real strategic purpose. That's different than just casually saying blank this, blank that. Show them it's cool to be cognitively complex. Show them it's cool to be an energetic individual who's interested in doing more, not doing less. Be open. Don't be afraid to change your mind. They may have something to teach you. They may have a better answer. Your teaching partner may have a better answer. Be creative. Question things. Question the conventional wisdom. Tell them it's okay not to mimic the words of the man. And to say at some point, I don't think so. Here are some communication patterns which I think you should keep in mind in creating this psychosocial environment. In every communication with every student, send one or more of these messages. These messages create the psychosocial environment. Question messages from others which contradict these themes. If you hear messages in your group that contradict some of these themes, you need to question them. Here are some basic themes. Number one, the individual student is important. You, the student, are important. You're not here for me, I'm here for you. Second, debate can empower the student. You, the student, can be empowered by debate. It can empower your education, expand it, make it more potent. If you want to do well on standardized tests, you need to learn how to cut a lot of cards, because that will help you in your verbal scores. You students can be empowered by being able to make people listen. Many students have to empower themselves now through violence. Studies show that if they can express themselves and gain attention through communication, they won't have to use violence. Third, tell them, this is the radical thing, I am willing to have a personal, intellectual relationship with you. I am willing to have a personal, intellectual relationship with you. Not the open up your mind, I'm going to dump a bunch of stuff into it, but in terms of dialogue. I am willing to have a personal, intellectual dialogue with you. Not as your guru, not as your master, but someone who knows a bit more about today and is a bit older, but recognizes that we are both of the same basic intellect and certainly all of the same blood. Fourth, debate breeds success, the tools of success. This is the opening lecture of the Institute, which I'll be giving. I'm going to ask several of you to help me participate in that, maybe to witness a bit about what debate has done for you. But if you want to be a leader, if you want to be successful, if you want to be noticed, all the studies show that what you need to have are positive communication skills and critical thinking skills. That's how you become a leader. Not because you demand to be a leader, but because you have the behaviors that cause other people to point to you and say, that person is a leader. Five, ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. I think we need to respect the issues. We're tempted sometimes to use them as playing pieces to move around on our game board. And as the person who originated came into the paradigm for academic debate, I feel a little guilty of imposing this paradigm sometimes. But ideas are important because they're essentially about people, ultimately about people, about the natural world, and how we interact. Apply debate ideas to yourself and others. Take that critique that your students are in, critique of schools that students are interested in, and apply that critique to them and their behaviors, or you and your behaviors. Ideas have consequences. Words have consequences as well. Words have, language is symbolic action. It can uplift, it can oppress, it can solve, it can cause. Oh, it's just words. When I call her a bitch, I don't really mean it in a nasty way. Right, well, how do you in a loving way? Right, that ideas and words have consequences. Six, these students belong to the community of today. Don't be afraid at some point to go up and shake a student's hand. Wow, that practice debate I saw you give, you know what? You are a debater. That's a big moment. I try to do that when my college students go to their very first debate tournament. After their first day of debating, in the East they'll have five rounds in one day. They deserve to have their hand shaken and said, now you are a debater. Once you become a debater, you will always be one. And tell them that they now are not an outsider, they're a member of the community of debate. Number 7, I believe in you. You can do it. You can't send that message too much. They don't receive this message. I don't care if you're from a rich family, a poor family, or whatever. Students don't get that message enough. They need to hear it. They're going to respect you. You're a dynamic, powerful, intellectual person. And when you say, I believe in you, you can do it. I think they're willing to listen. They're willing to take that to heart. Those are 7 messages that you should send. You should never be talking to a student for more than a minute or so without having sent at least one or more of those messages. Feel free to affirm them as messages. In teaching new students, you will confront immediate pedagogical challenges that you need to overcome. I just want to outline a dozen or so of them that you should keep in mind. First, use known examples. Don't use examples of things that they don't understand. Don't use examples that are not, because what examples do is give someone a context and allow them to fit abstract ideas into how they really work. And examples help do that. But if you give an example that's about fiduciary funding exchanges in day trading, that doesn't do it. You need to use known examples. You can't just assume that you can shoot examples off the top of your head. They may not be the ones that will work with them. You need to think about what you're going to be talking about in your group in advance. Think about examples that will work for your students. Second, break down the vocabulary barriers. Stop jargonizing your speech. Get rid of those debate jargon words. Steve Woods, who I believe is now one of the most powerful teachers of young debaters that I know of, he's working with the Future Stars Workshop right now. When he came to the University of Vermont, I had him give a lecture to brand new debaters. And it did not go well. It did not go well at all. And I listened to him and I told him why. Steve, they don't know what a disadvantage is. They don't know what perm means. They're not aware of what pull it across is about. And if you want them to imagine what pull it across is, you probably lost them. You must de-jargonize yourself. Super symbols that we use in debate are powerful tools, but they have to be shared before they can be useful. 3, think about the layering of knowledge. Think about the layering of knowledge. Start basic and then build up. You should say, well, can I talk to my students about this? Have they heard everything before that they need before we get to this? You can't just all of a sudden, Kate Schuster can only be here on Sunday. She wants to deliver a lecture about critique. Could she deliver an excellent lecture about critique to the basic students? Probably, but it's not right in terms of the layering of knowledge. So she's going to speak to the college students instead. Because we understand that even though she's a fabulous lecturer, it wouldn't fit in. Plan your curriculum accordingly. 4, don't underestimate any new debate. Don't underestimate any new debater. They may be new to debate, but they're not new to thinking. They're not new to speaking. You can rest assured that these students have been condescended to before, plenty of times, and they recognize it. And when you do it, they will recognize it. You have, and that's a tough challenge. You have to phrase things so that you can really communicate effectively, but you can't go too far. So remember that these students need language they can understand, but they're ready for new ideas and complex ideas if it's properly layered. Don't underestimate that. That's the most valuable advice that I've gotten in working with high school students who are new to debate from Will Baker. Don't underestimate them. They will surprise you, and they have. 5, don't leave anyone behind. There's always that goofy kid in your group was maybe not as into it, the other kids picked on him. The person who needs the most attention is the one who is falling behind. It's so easy for us to focus on the kids who are achieving the most. When I do an Urban Debate League tournament in New York, everybody rushes over to look at the top 20 speakers, and several times a year, I'll say, I'm not worried about the top 20 speakers, I'm worried about the bottom 20 speakers. They're the ones where debate is going to make the biggest difference in their life. And that should be true of students in your group. Six, watch and read the social signals. Watch and read the social signals. You need to be aware of nonverbal signals. Watch them during break. Watch how they interact working in groups. Use your outreach and work assignments to bring them together. Highly social students can be paired to work with students who aren't so social to try to bring them into the fold. Seven, learn from them. Learn by doing. Ask them what works. Give an evaluation after a few days and ask them to tell you what you like, what you don't, what don't you like, what would you like to see instead. Learn from them. Change if something doesn't work. Use trial and error. That's the essence of learning, and you have to continue doing it, especially as you teach. Eight, interactivity is necessary for involvement. Interactivity is necessary. If they don't ask enough questions, appoint people whose job it is to ask questions that day. Prompt questions. Get them speaking early. Give them feedback on their early speaking. Don't have them just listen. Have them act. They are active, curious kids who are ready to do this. But they want to be active. They don't gain their voice by just listening to yours. Nine, use cooperative problem solving. With each other, as faculty members, with them. Ask them how to solve a problem. Ask them what should happen. If nothing else, their participation in the process of deciding what to do will rally them in support of the course of action that's eventually decided on. That doesn't mean that if they all want to abolish class and go eat ice cream, that you agree to that. But certainly, you want them to feel a part of the decisions that are being made. 10, build in time for review and to ask questions. Repetition. It's a very important educational technique. We don't use it often enough. Maybe you have to talk about counterpoint competition twice, or three times, or four times. Don't be afraid to do that. 11, show discipline and responsibility. Show discipline and responsibility. You have to set an example. You have to be firm to your group so that you'll be there when they arrive. It's your job to be the first one there. Now, if somebody wants to try to beat you, that's okay. But you should be there minutes before your group starts. You can't expect them to be on time if you won't be on time. Discipline is a lesson we can only teach by example. Get coffee before it starts. Do your little bathroom business before it starts. Show discipline and students can learn it from you. 13, share. Share. Share the work. Everybody does work. Share the tasks. Everybody does the different tasks. No students are work mules. Share the product. You have produced this evidence. We should share it. Share everything inside your group, we'll share everything inside the Institute. Share success. Share success. When you finish your first evidence assignment, hold it up in front of them and say, look what you have done. It is excellent. Look at these excellent pieces of evidence. This one bracketed by William. This one bracketed by Sheila. This one, look at this excellent page of links. Tell them, you did this. You should be proud. You are a success And now in our next wave of arguments, we'll do even better. 14, grow with them. Grow with them. Learn from them. As they develop, you will develop. It's not just they who are learning and progressing and becoming better. It is you. We are all on our linear path to improvement, personally, spiritually, intellectually. Finally, make it fun. Make it fun. Otherwise, why bother? If it's not fun, then that doesn't mean that you should focus on fun. Debate is a game. Debate is a fun game. Let's play the game of debate. Let's try to play it in a fun way. Don't be too serious about things. Especially, don't take yourself too seriously. Students love it when you make jokes at your own expense. And they're also very unfamiliar with that as a communication pattern. And it really can endear you to them. Make it fun. Now, don't make it fun at the expense of the goofy student. Right? If you're going to make fun of someone, make fun of yourself. Make a deal between the two faculty members that you can make fun of each other. Think about ways in which they can be having fun. Allow them to listen to the music that they want while they're all cutting and taping stuff. So those are just some pedagogical challenges that you will face. And it's your responsibility to deal with all of those. In conclusion, I just want to say that we can never totally lose our social condition. But we have to work our own ongoing program of social conditioning to make ourselves more fully human in the way we explore and define who we are and what we do. And all of that has to be done with a little help from our friends. The students will need your help and the help of their classmates. You will need their help in becoming more the person you want. Don't wait for Judgment Day. My friends, every day is Judgment Day. Our journey as a sisterhood and brotherhood is eternal. I think it continues in each moment of our interaction. Every day, we build the world we want in what we do. I'm told by some that, well, I can't save the world. I can't really fix all this stuff. Very well, I accept that. But you can change the things which are within the sound of your voice and the reach of your hands. And that makes a very important linear difference. And if we can train and empower enough people to make that difference within the sound of their voice and the reach of their hands, before you know it, these islands of humanity can join and really make a difference. In a linear sense, every improvement is good. But if a critical